We expect our life partner to be our everything, to complete us. Thanks, Jerry Maguire. But even within that deep and lifelong union, only you can be your everything. Being at the ashram with people who weren't family or otherwise connected to us gave us a realistic perspective. There, it was clear that nobody could or should play every role. Interestingly, a Psychology Today article describes a field study of military leadership in Iraq done by Colonel J. Patrick Sweeney, a psychologist. Sweeney similarly found three C's of trust: competence, caring, and character. The difference is that he observed that all three qualities were necessary for soldiers to trust their leaders. Military and monk life both adhere to routine and principles, but monks aren't following their leaders and laying their lives on the line. To think like a monk about relationships, instead of looking for all four C's, set realistic expectations based on what a person actually gives you, not what you want them to give you. When they don't have all four C's, realize that you can still benefit from having them in your life. And you should be at least as attentive to what you can offer them. With friends or colleagues, get into the habit of asking yourself, what can I offer first? How can I serve? Am I a teacher, a peer, or a student? Which of the four C's do I give to this person? We form more meaningful relationships when we play to our strengths and, like Swami, don't offer expertise that we don't have. Exercises like the one above aren't meant to attach labels to people. I'm against labels, as I've explained, because they reduce the many nuanced hues of life to black and white. The monk approach is to look for meaning and absorb what you need to move forward instead of getting locked in judgment. However, when we apply filters like the four C's, we can see if our network of compassion is broad enough to guide us through the complexity and chaos of life. Even if we've got the four C's covered, we benefit from multiple viewpoints within each of these categories. A mother's care isn't the same as a mentor's. One person with character might give great romantic advice, while another might help you through a family argument. And one consistent friend might be there for you during a breakup, while another is always available for a spirited hike. Try this. Reflect on trust. Pick three diverse people in your life, perhaps a colleague, a family member, and a friend, and decide which of the four C's they bring to your life. Be grateful for that. Thank them for it. Make your own family. In order to find diversity, we have to be open to new connections. Part of growing up at any age is accepting that our family of origin may never be able to give us all that we need. It's okay to accept what you do and don't get from the people who raised you. And it's okay, necessary in fact, to protect yourself from those in your family who aren't good for you. We should have the same standards for our family as we do for everyone else. And if the relationship is fraught, we can love them and respect them from a distance while gathering the family we need from the wider world. This doesn't mean we should neglect our families, but forgiveness and gratitude come more easily when we accept that we have friends and family, and we have friends that become family. Feeling connected at some level to all of humanity can be positively therapeutic for those whose own families have made their lives difficult. The human family. When you enter a new community, as I entered the ashram, you have a clean slate. You have none of the expectations that have already built up among family and friends. Most likely, nobody shares your past. In situations like this, most of us rush to find our people. But the ashram showed me another way. I didn't need to replicate a family, creating a small circle of comfort and trust. Everyone in the ashram was my family. And as we traveled and connected with people across India and Europe, I began to recognize that everyone in the world was my family. As Gandhi said, The golden way is to be friends with the world and to regard the whole human family as one. The groups we establish for learning, growth, and shared experiences, like families, schools, and churches, help us categorize people. These are the people I live with. These are the people I learn with. These are the people I pray with. These are the people I hope to help. But I didn't want to discount someone's opinions or worth because they didn't fit neatly into one of these circles. Aside from the limits of practicality, there weren't certain people who deserved my attention or care or help more than others. It's easier to look at everyone as a member of your family if you don't imagine that it's every human at every moment. A well-known poem by Jean-Dominique Martin says, "People come into your life for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. These three categories are based on how long that relationship should endure. One person might enter your life as a welcome change. Like a new season, they are an exciting and enthralling shift of energy. But the season ends at some point, as all seasons do. Another person might come in with a reason. They help you learn and grow, or they support you through a difficult time. It almost feels like they've been deliberately sent to you to assist or guide you through a particular experience, after which their central role in your life decreases. And then there are lifetime people. They stand by your side through the best and worst of times, loving you even when you are giving nothing to them. When you consider these categories, keep in mind the circle of love. Love is a gift without any strings attached. This means that with it comes the knowledge that not all relationships are meant to endure with equal strength indefinitely. Remember that you are also a season, a reason, and a lifetime friend to different people at different times, and the role you play in someone else's life won't always match the role they play in yours. These days, there is a small, consistent group of people with whom I am closest, but that doesn't change the connection I feel to all humanity. And so I ask you to look beyond the people you recognize, beyond your comfort zone, to strangers and people you don't understand. You don't have to befriend them all, but see them all as equal, with equality of soul and the potential to add variety to your knowledge and experience. They are all in your circle of care. Try this. Be realistic about your friendships. Make a list of the people you have seen socially over the past week or two. In a second column, identify whether the person is a season, a reason, or a lifetime friend. This, of course, is labeling, which I've urged you not to do. We have to allow for fluidity in the roles people play, but roughly sketching the landscape of your current social life can give you an idea as to whether you are surrounded by a balanced group of people, one that provides excitement, support, and long-term love. Now, in a third column, consider what role you play for each of these people. Are you offering what you receive? Where and how could you give more? Trust is earned. Once you have established reasonable expectations from a relationship, then it is easier to build and maintain trust. Trust is central to every relationship. Trust means we believe that the person is being honest with us, that they have our interests at heart, that they will uphold their promises and confidences, and that they will stay true to these intentions in the future. Notice that I didn't say they are right all the time or handle every challenge perfectly. Trust is about intentions, not abilities. When an important person lets us down, the blow to our trust reverberates across all our relationships. Even people with the best intentions change or don't follow the same path that we do. Other people give us plenty of signs that their intentions don't mesh with ours, but we ignore them. And sometimes, if we were more aware, there are people we would know not to trust in the first place. Other people's behavior is always out of our control. So how can we trust anyone? Stages of trust. trust can be extended to anyone, from a taxi driver to a business partner to a lover. But obviously, we don't have the same level of trust for everyone. It's important to be attentive to how deeply we trust someone and whether they've actually earned that level of trust. Dr. John Gottman, one of the nation's top marriage experts, wanted to find out what makes couples get stuck in ongoing conflict instead of resolving it and moving on. He examined couples from all over the country, from varied socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds, and in a variety of life situations, from newlyweds to expecting parents, to families where one spouse was deployed in military service. Across the board, the most important issue to all of these couples was trust and betrayal. The language they used to describe their issues varied a bit, but the central question was always the same. Can I trust you to be faithful? Can I trust you to help with housework? Can I trust you to listen, to be there for me? The couples had good reason to make trust a priority. According to studies by Dr. Bella DiPaolo, people are dishonest in 1/5 of their interactions. 77 college students and 70 people from the community at large were asked to keep track of their social interactions for 7 days. They were told to record all of their exchanges and to note how many lies they told. I know what you're thinking. What if they lied about lying? To encourage honesty, the researchers told the participants that there was no judgment involved, and that their responses would help to answer fundamental questions about lying behavior. They also sold the experiment as a chance to get to know themselves better. In the end, the students reported some level of lying in 1/3 of their interactions, and the community members in 1 out of every 5 interactions. No wonder so many of us have trust issues. We know from our discussion of ego that we lie to impress, to present ourselves as better than we really are. But when these lies are discovered, the betrayal does far more damage to both people than honesty would have. If the seed of trust is not planted effectively in the beginning, we grow a weed of mistrust and betrayal. We aren't careful with when and how we give our trust. We either trust other people too easily, or we withhold our trust from everyone. Neither of these extremes serve us well. Trusting everyone makes you vulnerable to deception and disappointment. Trusting no one leaves you suspicious and alone. Our level of trust should directly correspond to our experience with a person, growing through 4 stages of trust. Neutral trust. When you meet someone, it is normal not to trust them. You may find them funny, charming, a joy to be around. These positive qualities do not merit trust. They mean you think your new acquaintance is cool. We tend to conflate trustworthiness with likability. In studies examining jurors' perceptions of expert witnesses, those the jurors found to be likable, they also rated as more trustworthy. We also tend to trust people we find attractive. Rick Wilson, co-author of Judging a Book by Its Cover, Beauty and Expectations in the Trust Game, says, "We found that attractive subjects gain a beauty premium in that they are trusted at higher rates. But we also found a beauty penalty when attractive people do not live up to expectations." When we equate likability or appeal with trust, we set ourselves up for huge disappointment. It is better to have neutral trust than to trust someone for the wrong reasons or to trust them blindly. Contractual trust. I derived this level of trust from Rajas, the impulsive mode of life, where you are focused on getting the results that you want in the short term. Contractual trust is the quid pro quo of relationships. It simply says, if I pay for dinner and you promise to pay me back, I have faith that you'll do it. If you make a plan, you can count on the person to show up and there's no further expectation. Contractual trust is useful. Most of us share contractual trust with the majority of people who cross our paths, yet we expect them to trust us implicitly. The heart may want a deeper connection, but we have to be discerning. Expecting more from someone who is only showing you contractual trust is premature at best and dangerous at worst. Mutual trust. Contractual trust reaches a higher level when you help someone, expecting they would most likely do the same for you in some way at some unknown time in the future. Where contractual trust relies on a specific exchange both parties have agreed to in advance, mutual trust is far looser. This stage of trust is derived from sattva, the mode of goodness, where we act from a place of goodness, positivity, and peace. We all want to get to this level, and good friendships usually do. Pure trust. The highest level of trust is pure goodness, when you know, no matter what happens, that another person has your back and vice versa. College basketball coach Don Meyer used to give each of his teammates a blank piece of paper on which he'd ask them to draw a circle to represent their foxhole. They wrote their names at the top of the circle, then drew lines at their left, right, and rear, and on each line they had to list the name of a teammate who they'd want in their foxhole with them. Those chosen most often by their teammates were the team's natural leaders. Choose your foxhole gang wisely. If you were to graph the number of people you trust at each level, the result would probably look like a pyramid. A lot of people at neutral trust, fewer people at contractual trust, your close circle at mutual trust, and only a handful at the top level, pure trust. No matter how dissatisfied you are with your pyramid, don't promote people without reason. They will only let you down. The biggest mistake we make is to assume that everyone else operates just like us. We believe that others value what we value. We believe that what we want in a relationship is what others want in a relationship. When someone says, "I love you," we think they mean exactly what we mean when we say, "I love you." But if we think everyone is a reflection of ourselves, we fail to see things as they are. We see things as we are. Mutual trust requires patience and commitment. It is built on a true understanding of the person in spite of and because they are separate from us and view the world differently. The way to step back from making presumptions is to closely observe their words and behaviors. When people show you their level of trust, believe them. I want you to feel grateful for the people you can trust and to feel honored by those who trust you. If you have neutral trust for someone, that's cool too. Accept people as they are and you give them the chance to grow and prove to be more. We set ourselves up for long-term trust when we let it evolve naturally. Trust is a daily practice. Relationships rarely get to a point where both participants can say, "I absolutely know this person and they absolutely know me." Like a curve that continually approaches but never reaches a line, you never get to the point of saying, "I trust them fully and they trust me fully, forever and ever." Trust can be threatened in small and large ways and needs to be reinforced and rebuilt on a daily basis. Build and reinforce trust every day by making and fulfilling promises, contractual trust, giving those you care about sincere compliments and constructive criticism, going out of your way to offer support, mutual trust, standing by someone even when they are in a bad place, have made a mistake, or need help that requires significant time, pure trust. An intentional love life. Now that we have some tools to assess the roles people play in our lives, let's look at how we can deepen existing relationships and build strong new ones. Letting go of traditional family roles allowed us monks to broaden our connections with humanity. In the same way, celibacy freed the energy and attention that romantic love had consumed. Now, before you stop listening, I'm not recommending celibacy for non-monks. Celibacy is an extreme commitment and hardly an essential one for everyone. But it did lead me to revelations that I'd like to share. Let's say I did it so you don't have to. To stop drinking, that was easy for me. To stop gambling, I'd never done much of that in the first place. And I'd stopped eating meat at 16. For me, giving up romantic relationships was the hardest sacrifice. It sounded ridiculous, even impossible. but I knew the purpose behind it: to save the effort and energy that went into being validated in a romantic relationship and to use it to build a relationship with myself. Think of it the same way. Giving up sugar sounds like a drag. What sane person would want to forego ice cream? Well, we all know there's a good reason: to be healthy and live longer. When I looked at the monks, I could see that they were doing something right. Remember Matthew Ricard, the world's happiest man? All the monks I met looked so young and seemed so happy. My romantic entanglements hadn't brought me fulfillment, so I was willing to try the experiment of self-control and discipline. When I became a monk, one of my college friends asked, "What are we going to talk about? All we used to do was talk about girls." He was right. So much of my life had been absorbed in navigating romantic connections. There's a reason we watch countless sitcoms and movies about romance. It's endlessly entertaining. But as with any entertainment, it takes time away from serious matters. If I'd been dating or in a committed relationship for those 3 years instead of being at the ashram, I wouldn't be where I am today, with understanding of my strengths and who I am. The Sanskrit word for monk is brahmacharya, which can be translated to the right use of energy. In the dating world, when you walk into a bar, you look around to see who is attractive, or you swipe through potential mates online without giving a second thought to how much time you spend in effort to hook up. But imagine if you could buy that time back for yourself. If you could recoup everything you've ever invested in relationships that didn't pan out. That attention and focus could be used for creativity, friendship, introspection, industry. Now, this doesn't mean every failed relationship is a waste of time. On the contrary, we learn from each mistake. But think of the time around the relationship, waiting for texts, wondering if they like you, trying to make someone change into the person you want them to be. If we are thoughtful about our needs and expectations, our time and energy go to far better use. Sexual energy is not just about pleasure. It is sacred. It has the power to create a child. Imagine what it can create within us when it's harnessed. Certified sex educator Marla Madrone says, "Celibacy by conscious choice is a powerful way to work with your own energy and harness the potency of life energy. It can also help you strengthen your intuition, your boundaries, and your understanding of what consent truly means, including how to differentiate what kind of contact and interaction is truly welcome in your life and by your body. But your energy is squandered when it is spent tailoring yourself to someone else's ideal or shaping yourself into the person you think he wants or suspecting her of cheating on you. There is so much anxiety and negativity around dating and so much pressure to find the one, never mind whether we're ready or able to settle down with anyone. Once the element of romantic pursuit was removed, I wasn't trying to promote myself as a boyfriend, to look good, to make women think anything of me, to indulge lust. I found my connections with female friends, with all my friends, growing deeper. I had more physical and mental space and energy for their souls. My time and attention were better spent. Again, I'm not suggesting you give up sex, though you certainly could. But what if you could give yourself permission to be single by yourself, able to focus on your career, your friends, and your peace of mind? Minister and philosopher Paul Tillich said, "Our language has wisely sensed these two sides of man's being alone. It has created the word loneliness to express the pain of being alone, and it has created the word solitude to express the glory of being alone." I spent 3 years as a monk, 3 years developing my self-awareness, at the end of which I was able to ask myself the right questions about a relationship. I may not have spent all of my waking hours in sattva, the mode of goodness, but I knew where I wanted to be and how it felt. I had the opportunity to become the person I would want to date. Instead of looking for others to make me happy, I was able to be that person for myself. Attraction versus connection. Our increased intentionality gives us a clearer perspective with which to evaluate why we are initially attracted to people and whether those reasons support our values. There are 5 primary motivations for connection, and note that these don't exclusively apply to romantic prospects. Number 1, physical attraction. You like what they look like, you're drawn to their appearance, style, or presence, or you like the idea of being seen with them. Number 2, material. You like their accomplishments and the power and/or the possessions this affords them. Number 3, intellectual. You like how they think, you're stimulated by their conversation and ideas. Number 4, emotional. You connect well. They understand your feelings and increase your sense of well-being. Number 5, spiritual. They share your deepest goals and values. When you identify what's attracting you, it's clear if you're attracted to the whole person or just a part. In my experience, ask most people what attracts them to another person, and they'll mention some combination of the top 3 qualities: looks, success, and intellect. But those qualities alone don't correlate with long-term, fortifying relationships. Monks believe that someone's looks aren't who they are. The body is only a vessel for the soul. Similarly, someone's possessions aren't theirs. They certainly don't tell you about the person's character. And even if you're attracted to someone's intellect, there's no guarantee it will lead to a meaningful bond. These 3 qualities don't correlate with long-term fortifying relationships, but they do show your chemistry with another person. The last 2, emotional and spiritual, point to a more profound, lasting connection. They show your compatibility. Quality, not quantity. When it comes to the energy we expend and receive in relationships, the focus is quality, not quantity. I often hear from guilty parents, usually mums, that they feel bad having to work long hours and lose out on time with their kids. According to the first ever large-scale study of the impact of mothers' time, it's the quality of time spent with kids, not the quantity, that counts. That means put away your phone during family time. I'm not a parent, but I know that as a child, I always felt my mom's energy. I never measured how much time she spent with me. My mother worked, and as a young child, I went to daycare. I don't have a single memory from daycare, no painful memories of her absence, but I do remember her coming to pick me up. She'd always smile and ask me about my day. This is true in all relationships. Nobody wants to sit with you at dinner while you're on the phone. This is where we confuse time and energy. You can spend a whole hour with someone, but only give them 10 minutes of your energy. I'm not able to spend much time with my family, but when I'm with them, I'm 100% there. I'd rather spend 2 hours with them, focused and engaged, than give them partial, distracted energy for a whole weekend. A monk shows love through presence and attention. In the ashram, time invested was never seen as a reliable measure of care or engagement. As I've mentioned, after a meditation, nobody asked how long you'd meditated. They asked how deep you'd gone. If you have dinner together every night, great. But what is the quality of the conversation? Think like monks do, in terms of energy management, not time management. Are you bringing your full presence and attention to someone? Try this, handcuff attention thieves. These days, most of us are losing a battle for our attention. The victors are our screens. The only way to give another person your complete attention for a period of time is to turn off your screens. To give someone in your life the focus they deserve, sit down with them to agree on rules surrounding the phone, the laptop, and the TV. Choose specific activities that will be your quality time without distraction. Agree to turn off your phones, put them in another room, or leave them at home. This may be a challenge at first. Perhaps conversation will lag, or friends and colleagues will be frustrated because they can't reach you. Setting these boundaries will establish new expectations on both fronts. Lapses in conversation will lose their awkwardness. Friends and colleagues will accept that you are not available 24/7. 6. Loving exchanges. Most couples don't sit down together, draw up a list of values, and see whether they share them. But once we have clarity about ourselves, we can connect with others in a more intentional way. The Upadeshamrita talks about 6 loving exchanges to encourage bonding and growing together. There are 3 types of exchanges. Each involves giving and receiving, thus adding up to 6. They help us build a relationship based on generosity, gratitude, and service. Gifts. Giving charity and receiving whatever is offered in return. This seems obvious or maybe even materialistic. We don't want to buy each other's affection, but think about what it means to give to another person with intention. Do you get flowers for your partner on Valentine's Day? This is a very conventional gesture, so consider whether it is one that brings your partner the most joy. If flowers it is, did you walk them past a flower shop 6 months ago to suss out their preferences in preparation for this day? Or did you text a secret query to their closest friend? Both actions entail a lot more intention than just ordering some roses online, though of course, that's better than completely forgetting the day. Is Valentine's Day the best moment to express your love? Or would an unexpected gesture be even more meaningful? Have you taken the time to contemplate what an ill friend would really like? Maybe it isn't an object, but an action, a service, our time. Cleaning their car, organizing activities, helping them with obligations, or bringing them someplace beautiful. You can bring the same thoughtfulness to receiving a gift. Are you grateful for the effort that went into the gift? Do you understand why and what it means for the giver? Conversation. Listening is one of the most thoughtful gifts we can give. There is no better way to show that we care about another person's experience. Listening intentionally means looking for the emotions behind the words, asking questions to further understand, incorporating what you've learned into your knowledge of the other person, doing your best to remember what they said, and following up where relevant. Listening also involves creating an atmosphere of trust where the person feels welcome and safe. It is also important to share your own thoughts and dreams, hopes and worries. The vulnerability of exposing yourself is a way of giving trust and showing respect for another person's opinion. It enables the other person to understand the previous experiences and beliefs you bring to whatever you do together. Try this. Make your conversation into a gift. Ideally, you try to do this in conversations regularly, but this time, do it with focus and intention. Pick a moment you have coming up with someone important to you, a friend, a relative, your partner. Maybe it's a meal or a walk you'll be taking together. During this time, shut off your phone. Give all your focus to the other person. Instead of having an agenda, be curious. If a topic doesn't emerge, ask them open-ended questions to land on a subject that's important to them. What's on your mind lately? How's your relationship with X? Listen carefully, ask follow-up questions. Share your own experiences without turning the conversation to yourself. A few days later, email or text a friend to follow up. Food. The world was a very different place when the Upadeshamrita was written, of course, and I interpret this exchange of food broadly to mean the exchange of experiences, any tangible expression of care and service that nourishes body or spirit, like giving a massage, creating a relaxing space for the other person in the home, or putting on music you know they enjoy. On a grander scale, my wife left her beloved family and moved to New York so she could live with me, an expression of care and generosity that nourished me more than I can say. Once we were in New York, I introduced her to other women to help her find a community. The experiences we exchanged didn't have to be perfectly matched. We look for what the other person needs most. These 6 exchanges can be thoughtless and empty, or they can have true depth and meaning. But don't judge people's efforts without giving them a chance to succeed. Nobody can read minds. If your roommate or partner doesn't guess that you want them to organize your birthday party, it's not their fault. Instead, be clear and honest with them about what you need. Try this. Ask for what you want. Tell the important people in your life how you like to receive love. When we don't tell people what we want, we expect them to read our minds and often judge them for failing to do so. This week, be more genuine in asking people for help rather than waiting for them to predict what you want. 1. Think of a complaint you have about a loved one's behavior. But don't look too hard for faults. If nothing springs to mind, that's a great sign and you should skip this exercise. 2. Dig to the root of the problem. Where is the real dissatisfaction? You might find that your need corresponds to the loving exchanges. Do you want more time to share and connect? Conversation? Do you feel unappreciated? Gifts? Do you want more support? Food or other acts of service? 3. Articulate it without criticism. Say, "This is what would make me feel more loved and appreciated," instead of, "You do this wrong." In this way, you give a companion a path to connection, which is easier for them and more likely to fulfill you. Ready for love. The 6 loving exchanges lay a foundation for any close relationship, but most of us are looking for the one. The Harvard Grant Study followed 268 Harvard undergraduates for 75 years, collecting piles of data about them along the way. When researchers combed through the data, they found a single factor that reliably predicted the quality of participants' lives: love. Participants could have every other external marker for success: money, a thriving career, good physical health, but if they didn't have loving relationships, they weren't happy. We all come to relationships with different levels of self-awareness. With the encouragement of online quizzes and dating apps, we list the characteristics we want in a partner: sense of humor, caring, good looking, but we don't look at what we really need. How do we want to be cared for? What makes us feel loved? In How to Love, Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "Often we get crushes on others, not because we truly love and understand them, but to distract ourselves from our suffering. When we learn to love and understand ourselves and have true compassion for ourselves, then we can truly love and understand another person." After the ashram, when I was ready for a relationship, which was not, as some friends assumed, the moment I left, my sense of what I wanted in a partner was steered by self-knowledge. I knew what would complement me and what wouldn't. I knew what I needed in my life and what I had to offer. My ability to find the right relationship evolved because I had evolved. As it happened, Radhi Devalukya, the woman who had become my wife, already had this self-knowledge too. Without the need for the same journey I'd made, she knew she wanted to be with someone spiritually connected with high morals and values. I believe she would have done just fine without me, but I know my life would have been different, full of pain, if I hadn't taken the time to work on myself before diving into a serious relationship. According to Massive Attack, love is a verb. Dan in real life says, love is an ability. The Dalai Lama says, love is the absence of judgment. Love is also patient, it's kind. And apparently, love is all you need. With so many definitions of love in our culture, it's all a bit confusing. And I was confused, despite all my monk experience, my self-exploration and intentionality and compassion, when I ventured out on my first date back in London. I already know I like her. The Think Out Loud group I started in college continued for some years after I left, and I stayed in touch, visiting and lecturing when I came to London. Radhi was part of that community, had come to some of my lectures, and had become friends with my sister. Now, people from that community, including me and Radhi, have joined together to organize a charity event against racism and bullying for young kids in England. Seeing Radhi in that context has told me more about her than I would have learned on a dating profile, or even after a few dates. I've seen how respectful she is with everyone on the team. She has interesting opinions and cool ideas. I've had a chance to get a real look at who she is. Anyone can be their online profile for a one-hour date. It may be their best self, but it doesn't give the full picture. I still haven't got a full-time job, but I've been tutoring to make a bit of money. I've saved up a month's earnings, and I take Radhi to the theater to see Wicked. Then I bring her to La Canda Locatelli, a fancy restaurant that's way above my pay grade. She's polite, but unimpressed. Afterwards, she says, "You didn't have to do this," and confesses that her ideal date would be going to a supermarket, walking the aisles, and buying some bread. I'm mystified. Who would want to do that? I hadn't had any relationship since becoming a monk, and I had yet to reconcile who I was spiritually with how I used to date. I felt like I had one foot in each world. In spite of my monk training, I snapped right back into my old relationship mode, the one where I tried to give the other person what media, movies, and music told me they wanted, instead of developing my awareness of who they were. I myself love gifts and extravagant demonstrations of love, and for a while I cluelessly continued to shower Radhi with grand gestures. I got it completely wrong. She wasn't impressed by any of that. She's not very fancy. Even after my years in the ashram, I could still be swayed by external influences or my own preferences rather than careful observation of what she liked. But after my initial missteps, I was aware enough to figure it out. And thank God she married me. If you don't know what you want, you'll send out the wrong signals and attract the wrong people. If you aren't self-aware, you'll look for the wrong qualities and choose the wrong people. This work is what we've talked about throughout this book. Until you understand yourself, you won't be ready for love. Sometimes we find ourselves making the same mistake over and over again, attracting the same sort of incompatible partners or picking them in spite of ourselves. If this happens, it isn't bad luck. It's a clue that we have work to do. The monk perspective is that you carry pain. You try to find people to ease that pain, but only you can do that. If you don't work through it, it stays with you and interferes with your decisions. The problematic people who emerge reflect your unresolved issues, and they will keep reappearing until you learn the lesson you need to learn. As Ianla Van Zandt said to Oprah, "Until you heal the wounds of your past, you will continue to bleed. You can bandage the bleeding with food, with alcohol, with drugs, with work, with cigarettes, with sex, but eventually it will all ooze through and stain your life. You must find the strength to open the wounds, stick your hands inside, pull out the core of the pain that is holding you in your past, the memories, and make peace with them. Once you've unpacked your own bags and you've healed yourself, mostly, then you'll come to relationships ready to give. You won't be looking to them to solve your problems or fill a hole. Nobody completes you. You're not half. You don't have to be perfect, but you have to come to a place of giving. Instead of draining anyone else, you're nourishing them. Keeping love alive. Remember when we talked about the mind? We said that happiness comes when we are learning, progressing, and achieving. And yet, as a relationship lengthens, we tend to long for the honeymoon phase, when we were first falling in love. How many times have you been in a relationship and said to yourself, "I wish I could feel like that again," or "I wish we could go back to that time"? But going to the same place for dinner or to the place you had your first kiss won't bring back all the magic. Many of us are so addicted to recreating the same experiences that we don't make space for new ones. What you were actually doing at the start of your relationship was creating new memories with energy and openness. Love is kept alive by creating more new memories, by continuing to learn and grow together. Fresh experiences bring excitement into your life and build a stronger bond. I have many recommendations for activities couples can do together, but here are a couple of my favorites drawn from monk principles. Number one, find new in the old. Remember when, as monks, we looked for a special stone on the same walk we took together every day? you too can open your eyes to the world you already live in. Have a candlelit dinner in the middle of the week. Read a book to each other before bed instead of staring at your phones. Take a walk together in the neighborhood and challenge each other to find a certain kind of mailbox or to be the first to spot a bird. Number two, find new ways to spend time together. A study by psychologist Arthur Aron found that couples strengthen their bonds when they do new and exciting activities together. My wife and I started to do escape rooms together. An escape room is a game where you're both locked in a room and have to find a way out. The staff gives you a few clues and you have to work together to solve many steps of the puzzle. It may sound a little creepy, but it's actually a lot of fun. You get to learn together, get to make mistakes together. It's an even playing field when neither of you has more experience or expertise than the other. When you experiment together as a couple, you feel yourselves growing together in all areas of your life. You could even try something really scary together, like skydiving or something else that's outside your comfort zone. Remember all the benefits that we found in getting close to our fears? Playing with fear together is a way to practice going into your deeper fears, sharing them with your partner, feeling their support, and together transforming fear. Number three, serve together. Just as serving gives meaning to your life, serving with your partner adds meaning to your connection, whether it's organizing charity events, feeding the homeless, or teaching something together. My most bonding experiences in monk life came about when I took part in collective projects. The horrid two-day train journey that I've mentioned, planting trees together, building a school. Instead of focusing on the challenges of the relationship, we develop a shared perspective on real-life issues. Connecting for a higher purpose, we feel gratitude and bring that back into our relationship. I know many couples who have met through volunteering, so if you're looking for a well-suited partner, find a cause that is close to your heart. If you meet through an activity such as volunteering, from the start you already have something very deep in common, and you're more likely to form a deeper bond. Number four, meditate and chant together. When a couple who has just had an argument comes into a room, you can feel the negative energy vibrating between them. The opposite is true when you and your partner chant together. You're bringing your energy to the same place and feel literally in tune with each other. Number five, finally, envision together what you both want from the relationship. When you are aware of what is most important to each other, then you can figure out how much you're willing to adapt. Ideally, each of you is striving to live in your own dharma. In the best of relationships, you get there together. Overcoming heartbreak. It can be hard to see clearly when your heart is at stake, but there is one point I want to make abundantly clear. There is a difference between being grateful for what you have and settling for less than you deserve. If we are still listening to our child minds, we're attracted to people who aren't good for us but make us feel better in the moment. Don't wrap your self-esteem around someone else. Nobody deserves verbal, emotional, or physical abuse. It is better to be alone. Nor should you allow an abusive, manipulative, or toxic relationship to transition into friendship. The dynamic won't change, trust me. In every relationship, you have the opportunity to set the level of joy you expect and the level of pain you'll accept. No relationship is perfect, but if joy never reaches a certain height or holds to a low average, that won't change unless you both put in a lot of work. The same is true for how much disappointment you're willing to bear. Your connection may get a slow start. It can take a while to know each other, but if it never reaches a satisfying level, you need to decide whether to accept it or move on. I know it's not easy. When you've spent quality time with someone, when you've invested in someone, when you've given yourself to someone, it's so hard to let go. Tibetan Buddhist nun Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo points out that we often mistake attachment for love. She says, we imagine that the grasping and clinging that we have in our relationships shows that we love. whereas actually it is just attachment which causes pain. Because the more we grasp, the more we are afraid to lose. Then if we do lose, then of course we are going to suffer. Ultimately, holding on to the wrong person causes us more pain than letting go. The strategies I recommend to overcome heartbreak tie directly to monk ideas of the self and how we find our way toward peace and purpose. No matter what thought we have, we don't run away from it. We give ourselves space to assess and make changes. Spot, stop, swap. Feel every emotion. It's possible to distract yourself from heartbreak, but the fix is only temporary. And if you deny your feelings, you end up suffering in other ways. Researchers followed incoming college freshmen to see how well they adapted to their transition and found that those with a tendency to suppress their emotions had fewer close relationships and felt less social support. Instead, think about how the other person has made you feel in this situation. You might want to articulate your feelings by writing them down or recording them. Read what you've written and listen back objectively. Do you hear any recurring patterns? You can also do a question meditation, asking yourself about the loss. We like to replay emotions, how perfect it was, how it could have been, how we thought it was going to go. Instead of reflecting on how romantic the relationship was before it crashed and burned, focus on the reality. What were your hopes for the relationship? What did you lose? Is your disappointment tied to who the person was or who they weren't? Explore your emotions until you uncover the root of the pain and disruption. Learn from the situation. Movies, music, and other media send us limited, often inaccurate messages about what love should look like. Use the reality of the breakup to set realistic expectations about what you deserve and need from a new relationship, and remember that yours can be different from the person you broke up with and/or the next person to come along. What was the biggest expectation you had that wasn't met? What was important to you? What was good in the relationship? What was bad? What was your role in its demise? Instead of exploring your pain here, you want to investigate the workings of the relationship in order to identify what you want from your next relationship and what you might have to work on in yourself. Believe in your worth. You may undervalue yourself in the moment of a breakup, but your value doesn't depend on someone's ability to fully appreciate you. If you wrap your identity around the relationship, the pain you feel is that you've had to sacrifice that part of your identity. If you expect one person to fulfill all your needs, then of course there is a vacuum when they're gone. Now that you're single, use this time to build a community of people with shared interests whom you want to be in your life forever. Make yourself whole. You need to be someone who makes you happy. Wait before dating again. Remember, if you haven't healed past pain, you might miss your next opportunity for an incredible connection with an incredible person. Don't rebound or revenge date. This only causes more hurt and regret that spread further, a virus of pain. Instead, take some time to get to know yourself better. Build your self-esteem, invest in your growth. If you've lost yourself in the relationship, find yourself in the heartbreak. The monk way is to build awareness, address, and amend. Either within a relationship or before we enter one, we take a step back to evaluate and make sure we understand our own intentions. Then we can venture into the dating world or return to the relationship with self-awareness and love. Spot, stop, swap. We've turned our attention outward to address the intimate relationships in our lives. Now we come to our relationship with the larger world. I mentioned that at the ashram, I felt a bond beyond my ties to my family, a far greater force uniting and connecting us all. The astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson said, "We are all connected to each other biologically, to the Earth chemically, and to the rest of the universe atomically. Knowing this, we must look to the universe to find true meaning in our lives. Eleven. Service. Plant trees under whose shade you do not plan to sit. The ignorant work for their own profit, the wise work for the welfare of the world. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, verse 25. I am a novice at the ashram, and we've been dropped off in a village with no money and no food with the mission to find our own way for 30 days. The weather is decent, and we've been given a warehouse for shelter. We leave our mats there and venture into the village. There are simple huts from which people sell food, spices, and sundries. Laundry is strung between the huts. Most people travel by bike or on foot. Some of the children are barefoot. Untethered, without a plan, the first thing we feel is fear, which provokes us to do whatever it takes to survive. We ask for handouts. People in India are generous and often give bread, fruit, or coins to people in spiritual dress. We visit the temple where pilgrims are given free food called prasad. This is sanctified food that is offered to God, then handed out. Anxious about our survival, we resort to selfishness and hoarding. By the second week, we're in better shape. We've figured out that we can earn our provisions by offering help to people in the village. We start assisting people with heavy loads or peddlers who could use a hand with their carts. We soon learn that opening our hearts and souls encourages others to do the same. The donations we receive aren't dramatically different from the ones we got when we first arrived, but the exchange gives us a warm sense of communal compassion and generosity, and I feel like I've absorbed the lesson of our journey. We thought we had nothing, and indeed we had barely any material possessions, but we were still able to give people our effort. However, by the final week, we're well fed and secure enough to notice something deeper. Though we had come with nothing, we still had a certain kind of wealth. We are stronger and more capable than a lot of the people in the village. There are seniors, children, and disabled people on the street, all of them in greater need than we are. I feel bad, one monk says. This is short term for us. For them, it's forever. I think we're missing something, I add. We can do more in this village than survive. We recall Helen Keller's refrain, I cried because I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet. This is unfortunately no exaggeration. In India, you often see people with missing limbs. I realize that now that we have found our way, we can share the food and money we have received with those who aren't as able as we are. Just when I think I've learned the lesson of our journey, I come upon a revelation that affects me profoundly. Everyone, even those of us who have already dedicated our lives to service, can always give more. The three stages of transformation felt like a microcosm of the entire monk experience. First, we let go of the external and the ego. Second, we recognize our value and learn that we don't need to own anything in order to serve. And third, we continually seek a higher level of service. On that trip, I recognize that there is always room to rise. There is always more to give. Sister Christine Vladimirov, a Benedictine nun, as quoted in the Monastic Way, wrote, "Monastic spirituality teaches us that we are on a journey. The journey is inward to seek God in prayer and silence. Taken alone, we can romanticize this aspect of our life. But to be monastic, there is a parallel journey, the journey outward. We live in community to grow in sensitivity to the needs of others. The monastery is then a center to come out of and to invite others into. The key is to always maintain both journeys, inward and outward." The highest purpose. In his lecture at my college, Gauranga Das had inspired me when he said, plant trees under whose shade you do not plan to sit. That sentence captivated me and launched me on a trajectory that I had never imagined. And now I have to make a confession. I've been holding out on you. We have talked about how to let go of the influences of external noise, fear, envy, and false goals. We have explored how to grow by harnessing our minds, our egos, and our daily practices to live in our Dharma. All of this is toward the goal of leading fulfilling, meaningful lives, a worthy path. But here, and on social media, and in my classes, and in every medium in which I teach, I haven't yet revealed the most important lesson I learned as a monk, and one that I carry with me every day of my life. Drumroll, please. The highest purpose is to live in service. It's not that I've been keeping service a secret, I mention it often, but I've waited until now to talk about the central role I believe it should play in all of our lives because, frankly, I think most of us are somewhat resistant to the idea. Sure, we want to help those in need, and maybe we already find ways to do so, but we are limited by the pressure and needs of our own work and lives. We want to solve our own issues first. Jay, I'm the only one who needs help. I have so much to figure out before I can devote myself to helping others. It's true. It's hard to think about selflessness when we are struggling. And yet, that is exactly what I learned as a monk. Selflessness is the surest route to inner peace and a meaningful life. Selflessness heals the self. Monks live in service, and to think like a monk ultimately means to serve. The Monastic Way quotes Benedictine monk Dom Elred Graham as saying, "The monk may think he has come to the monastery to gain something for himself. Peace, security, quiet, a life of prayer, or study, or teaching. But if his vocation is genuine, he finds that he has come not to take, but to give. We seek to leave a place cleaner than we found it, people happier than we found them, the world better than we found it." We are nature, and if we look at and observe nature carefully, nature is always serving. The sun provides heat and light. Trees give oxygen and shade. Water quenches our thirst. We can, and monks do, view everything in nature as serving. The Srimad Bhagavatam says, "Look at these fortunate trees. They live solely for the benefit of others. They tolerate wind, rain, heat, and snow, but still provide shelter for our benefit. The only way to be one with nature is to serve. It follows that the only way to align properly with the universe is to serve, because that's what the universe does." The 16th century guru Rupa Goswami talks about Yukta Vairagya, which means to do everything for a higher purpose. That's real detachment, utter renunciation, perfection. Some monk sects strictly apply this standard to their practices, stripping themselves of material possessions altogether. But in reality, the rest of us need to work for a living. We're all going to end up owning stuff, but we can look at how we use what we have. We can use our homes to foster community. We can use our money and resources to support causes we believe in. We can volunteer our talents for those in need. It's not wrong to have things if we use them for good. The Bhagavad Gita sees the whole world as a kind of school, an education system structured to make us realize one truth. We are compelled to serve, and only in service can we be happy. Like fire is hot, as the sun is light and warm, service is the essence of human consciousness. Know the reality of the world in which you live. Know it to be impermanent, unreal, and the source of your suffering and delusion. Seeing the purpose of life to be sense gratification, making ourselves feel good, leads to pain and dissatisfaction. Seeing it as service leads to fulfillment. Service is good for the body and soul. Service fulfills us on many levels. beginning with my simple belief that we're born wired to care for others, so service does us good. This instinct is most obvious in children, who aren't yet distracted by other demands on their time and attention. An image that went viral shows a little girl, probably about 2 years old, watching a politician crying on Japanese TV. She takes a tissue, goes up to the TV, and tries to wipe away the politician's tears. Such things go viral because we recognize, and perhaps miss, the little girl's compassion for another person, even a stranger. In Long Walk to Freedom,